Welcome to a Bowden Education podcast. In this podcast, we'll be discussing reflections on the challenges of navigating the education system as a dyslexic child and student with Tom Delaham. Tom is a former A&E nurse and is now a university senior lecturer in adult nursing, as well as being the recipient of the Times Higher Award for Most Innovative Teacher of the Year 2019. Welcome, Tom.
Hi.
So, firstly, reflect or talk to me about your school experience in a nutshell, and maybe explain how you perceive or what your needs were and are indeed.
Okay, so the best way to sort of term it is to use what sort of opened up the understanding for me, which was around a perspective really of the fact that a lot of children probably don't engage with a learning environment because their method of learning is very different to that of maybe the culture that exists within the room. Now, I didn't realise, and I became compliant actually over a long period of time with the way that an educator wanted to have a room run or time or be facilitated. But the reality was I would spend a lot of my time looking out of the window. Now, I've said that to a lot of people actually, and I think that that's quite a common theme with the neuroatypical, is something called transcendental phenomenology, which is a really long word, which took me a long time to understand. But effectively, it's about making meaning through elements and through movement and through patterns. And so for me, light and movement and leaves and things that move outside of a classroom are just as relevant. And so if I looked out the window, sometimes it would be to make sense of things that I didn't really understand that were happening within the classroom. The issue, obviously, for a lot of educators is that is perceived as being disassociated, whereas it's actually trying to make association. And so often I was asked, either narratively led, so I was too chatty, disassociated because I looked out of the window, or ejected, thrown out because I asked questions that challenged what the educator was trying to kind of posit or put forward or assert. So I've learnt, and all of this language was stuff that's come very late on to me during the master's, being identified as having dyslexia. I had loads of mechanisms that I had kind of put together, really like a toolkit of how to not annoy people. But the truth was, when I had the assessment done at Canterbury Dyslexia Centre, she said she had never seen really a kind of a cascade of process to spatial awareness so sort of polar opposite as it was in my case. And she sort of asked, you know, how did you manage? And I explained exactly as I'm explaining it to you, is I became passive. And so that passive kind of nature just sort of took me through, and I did well educationally. I've never had any problems. The problems I had were when I wanted to be creative, there wasn't the elements within the assessment criteria, learning outcomes, all of these things to help me, unless it was malleated by a bright educator who said, actually, Tom, you're quite gifted, let's make you do it this way. And I would then be given the air that I needed.
So you went through,
does that help?
Yeah. And you went through the education system then with a hidden disability.
Yeah, very much so.
And so you weren't formally diagnosed, if you like, until much, much later on. Were there no signs? Did teachers not pick up?
My mum was an educator. So she interestingly, she's also, I think, quite profoundly dyslexic. So she did her degree right at the end of her career and got a first and then retired. She became a play therapist, and she's an inspiration in a lot of ways to me. But she basically put me through all of the tests and everything. I came back, and this is one of the, I try not to liken it, but if I say the word, it reminds me of a song that I love, but it's borderline, right? So, you know, I won't sing because no one wants that. But effectively, that's what I was. I was like the borderline child. So they knew, but they just didn't. No one's ever known how to really manage. They still don't really know how to manage me and to manage expectations educationally, because my way of learning is not a norm. You know, I might take parts and bore myself. And I think we shared an article recently, which was an absolute eye-opener, because it just categorically told me my creative neuroatypicality was really important. And actually, if we were to think about it rationally and educationally, and models were being made more flexible, then we would be setting up really positive environments, because all of the innovations are going to come from neuroatypical people in the future, as Greta Thunberg and others are proving.
And so how do you think, looking back, how did your needs, or it might not be actually, having listened to what you've just said, but yeah, it might not be how your needs impacted your learning in the classroom, but how you as an individual child was responded to in the classroom by the teacher. So how do you think that combination maybe of how you, let's not call them needs, let's call them how you learnt and processed information, and then how the teachers dealt with that, i.e. probably telling you off for looking out the window, having been a teacher, that is a standard thing that teachers would do. How do you think that all impacted your learning through your school years?
Well, see, the interesting thing is, like, right now with you talking to me, like, no one can obviously see the kind of narrative that we're sharing, but the narrative that we're sharing is one where I am constantly looking away. You know, I have a problem with the kind of eye contact. You know, there are tendencies within my behavior patterns that would, you know, suggest that there's sort of a spectrum identification as well. So all of these things, I think, now would be understood a lot more. So I have had these really wonderful engagements with SEN practitioners, and I have really good relationships with them online. And my child has got the same neuroatypicality as me. His testing is identical. It's like a tracing paper, where he's got such emotional intellect and he's got such creativity. So it's really beautiful now, because it feels like I'm kind of learning to heal the kind of the harms done to me through the understanding and the love that I can offer the SEN practitioner, so that when he goes into an educational environment, it's a really wonderful opportunity. Because what I say to them is, thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for seeing him as he is, as he wants to be seen, as he identifies. And I know it's corny, but I put in a lot of my tweets that identify as a poet, because that's the narrative that I was always trying to use, because poetry for me breaks up words and it allows me a point of expression and understanding that's transcendental. Again, it's something that kind of overarches everything, so that then I can associate, because dyslexia tends to be associative. So, you know, borderline is music, but then it also is so many other things. You know, it's like words are so much more to me. So I think I would be fine in an education environment, more so now, because I think if you were to have given me an individual that would work kind of a little bit more one-to-one with me, and then be kind of moved away when I need them to be moved away, so I had that independent space as well, I would have, you know, flourished. The problem is that I still see that there's a very strong linear patternation and a grammar kind of identification of how learning should be structured, and that is just wrong. You know, there's no doubt that that's wrong. The system is flawed in a lot of ways, and COVID's proved that. But whether or not we learn, and I know that we're talking endlessly about how we can help to modify learning spaces with seminal thinkers like Jonathan Barnes, Dr. Sam Vale, Eleni, who are all going to be part of this kind of poetic PhD, and yourself, there is so much opportunity to change systems. But the problem is pressing that stop button and then restarting something.
Yeah, and I think when you take an individual teacher and working in teacher training myself, people enter the profession because they want to support children and students later on to learn and flourish, but then they join the system, and it's a very narrowing system. So if you think about when we first start school, things are quite relaxed. We like to teach through exploration and play and student-led learning. But this is all kind of narrowing to a point of now pretty much 100% exam, GCSEs and A-levels. And therefore, teachers have this real tension, don't they, about their own practice, because there's what they want to do, and potentially what they have to do and how they're judged because of outcomes that they need to produce. So it's really hard for teachers to navigate. So thinking back, and if you were to offer advice to teachers of yourself, or indeed say of your son, what kind of things do you think they could do within their classroom to help enhance that learning environment for people like you?
I think, so that's really interesting actually, and it just reminds me of so many. So Husserl's one, Antonovsky's another, Damasio, Chomsky, so many seminal things. Basically, thinkers that allow for spaces to be greater than the sum of their parts. We don't need to look at classrooms as being like the Lego brick wall. So I've written a couple of, I tend to verbally record blogs, and one of them was about allow the child to screw up the paper, allow the child to go outside the lines. When the child plays Lego and they want to play creatively, don't force them to build a brick wall. And I got quite animated and angry and vitriolic because it reminded me of all the things that I was kind of formalized to understand. So just, I would just allow for sort of a sense of expression, because what you'll find is within that, and within them looking outside, or even the physical movement. So, Einstein was classically told off often at a couple of the universities where he presided and talked, because he would take his classrooms out because he said he could not teach physics in a static environment. He had to take them out and show them a car, the movement of the air, all of these different things, rain, like, so he could explain the mathematics behind movements in life. You know, that's the issue, is that you can do all of these things, but actually some learners have to have this kind of blended approach. So maybe spend some time looking at those different pedagogical kind of frameworks, and allow yourself to open to the kind of opportunities that are out there. But it comes through a kind of, you know, I know we use it now, of unlearning and unknowing, but that's really central in my work, is trying again and trying to break some of those things that you hold as a truth, because maybe they're not a truth to the person learning in the classroom.
And learning in the classroom, going to what you said about taking learning out of the classroom, it is quite a stale, sterile even, box that we're putting children in, and they move from one box to the other every day with quite often lines of desks. And I know right now in COVID, and with COVID restrictions even more so, absolutely lines of desks, but they're not turning around and engaging, which leads to quite an isolated learning experience where eyes forward, and there are indeed some academy trusts where they expect their children's eyes to be forward and following the speaker. Yet, how can we start to maybe support and start some discourse around understanding that when children do look out of the window, when children are sometimes fiddling with their pen, or doing little scribbles on their page, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're not engaged and not listening. It is perhaps their way of processing what learning is happening. And how do you think we start that dialogue with maybe teachers and within the system more widely?
What you've got to do is you've got to start by sort of taking the educator in a position that's uncomfortable. So what I keep talking about is, like, I claim the corridor. So, you know, where I spent a lot of my education time was in the corridor. I would be ejected from the room, like, get out. I would try very hard to sort of attend to the needs of the educator. But often it would come to a point of dialogue, and sometimes I think they had preset themselves to this idea that, you know, the self-fulfilling prophecy was going to come true, that, you know, the class was going to come in, there was going to be noise, I would be central in that narrative because I would be trying to kind of find my way within this sort of social modicum, whatever people. I sort of stake a claim for the corridor, because actually why aren't we using those corridors more of an educational space? Why aren't we using them as a space for movement? Why aren't we allowing, you know, I'm sure that the problems are all around kind of health and safety of movement of children and all those things, but there's a reality to the fact that systems have to change. Educational models can't stay the same. What you've just described effectively is an Edwardian teaching environment, and you know, we're not in that period anymore. Children are multifaceted. They are very, very bright. And emotionally, they are resilient. And, you know, I really suggest that we look again at terms like snowflake, because I think COVID has proved that our snowflake generation has melted away. And actually, we're the ones that probably cause a lot of that issue. So maybe, you know, take educators in a position of discomfort and then give them the tools to build themselves back up again. And I'd love to do that. I'd love to come in as a poet laureate at our schools and say, right, I'm going to make you really uncomfortable, because I like doing that. I use silence quite a lot in my educational kind of metaphors. And actually, there's a piece hopefully that's going to be published by a student around the type of learning space that I create, which is really interesting for me, because I don't perceive that. So maybe educators just don't perceive the culture that they're creating, because it's, again, a self-fulfilling prophecy. They create a space that they hope isn't challenged. And when it is challenged, the person that challenges it needs to be subtracted and needs to be sent to the corridor.
And I'll come on to how you think that you managed to succeed in education despite spending a large amount of time in the corridor. Mm. When we talk about so often now, right now in the press, so much about lost learning time, that it's kind of, there's an irony there that so there are a bunch of children that do, particularly in secondary school, spend so much time in the corridors or in isolation rooms and so on. But I think going back to what you said about the educators, I think the compliance and the systematized culture within the classroom also, it's born out of a bit of fear and pressure and stress on teachers about performativity. So how are their children, how much are they progressing? Are they, you know, there's a lot of talk right now out there about catching, children need to catch up. And I keep asking, catch up with who? Yeah. Who are they behind? Who are they in front of? You know, and the late Sir Ken Robinson spoke about in one of his talks around being educated in batches, and actually the year of birth is the most common denominator of children's learning, challenging that, but it shouldn't be. Yet that's how we move through the education system, very much linking it to factory lines. But so there is that fear of teachers that they need to get the children to a certain point, and they're judged on that, and indeed potentially their pay is linked to that. But, and therefore they set up a system, or the system is set up around them to allow them to do that as efficiently as possible. So for example, when children do some work, and we've all seen it now for those of us that have educated at home, there's, it might be about using the focus of the learning might be about using descriptive language, and they need to then, they might have to write a poem. Now you'd quite like to do that. There are some children that would really not like to demonstrate their understanding of descriptive language through a poem, yet we're forcing all children down that funnel. So is there a step perhaps to say, let's think about how we're judging children's ability through the methods of maybe summative but certainly formative assessment that we're asking them, their product, what we're asking them to produce? Could there be a first step in saying descriptive language and show me however you would choose to?
I think the fact that I'm kind of part Norwegian would suggest that I would abolish assessment as the first part. I would try to kind of create kind of a more holistic kind of centre to the kind of educational model. And while you're talking, I'm looking at a piece that Sarah's doing for each of the boys, which is their loves. So for Sammy, you know, in order to know that he's needing to learn, you need to know that he loves apples. You know, you need to know that he loves swinging on swings up in the woods. And for the formative years, in his early years, he spent most of his time cuddling the chickens. You know, like, you need to know that about him. In order to educate Joel, you need to know that he's obsessed with training. He does nothing more than adore kind of repetition of movement. Much like me, there's a real poetry, and that would liken to, you know, this isn't just me being kind of whimsical, this is flow theory of Csikszentmihalyi and people that have said that, you know, great artists, great poets, great thinkers are flow theorists. They love that feeling of when they get into a point where it becomes automated. You know, when you throw a basketball, there's a real beauty in repetition of getting it right. You know, when you hit a golf ball, that's what he loves. He loves ice cream, he loves cups of tea. He's got a really sort of emotional palate as well. He loves really varied foods, hot, spicy. So all of these things, I think, are really important parts of kind of how we're made up. But the problem is that you've just said the common denominator is the birth age. You know, sadly, we need to be a little bit more kind of emotive than that, and we need to start thinking, what are we assessing for? The problem is, I could have a conversation with another good friend of mine who's got children that are very centered in the grammar, educational, streaming, kind of profiteering, tutoring, sort of getting them to this kind of gate. And the reality is, I'm the joke to them, because I'm like, what, how can I be in the position I'm in? How can my children be so comfortable with education as they are? Because we're not applying in the same way that they are, because they are Sisyphus, as far as I'm concerned. They're just all as a family pushing a rock up a hill. And I can't really abide by that. I try, and like I've said, I am a good boy. You know, I do sit now in conferences appropriately. But if I feel that there's a dishonesty, I will always challenge that. So I've had quite massive moments in large scale conferences where I've felt that people are lying. And there was one where I said, I think that what everyone needs to understand is that educationers are the least important people in the room. Because actually it's not about the educator, it's the demise of self that allows for the learning to take place. But we kid ourselves in thinking, and ego has this big involvement in that, we're the most important facilitator. No, the learner is the most important facilitator. So if you can create the kind of the medium, if you want, if you can create the soil and the ingredients and the light and the water, then that's when the magic and the germination happens. It's not to do with sitting there staring for hours at the soil, because you're wasting your time. They're each going to grow at different points, at different times. They're going to break the seed in different ways. And I'm that example. I'm like the one that they gave up on. They're like, that one's definitely not coming. You know, what on earth is that about? And then lo and behold, you know, at 40, I'm like, you know, suddenly realizing, actually, you know, I've reached points of enlightenment in my life, and I can't understand or quantify that. I get a distinction in my master's, but I'm like, I don't want it. Have it back, because you don't really understand who I am. So it doesn't make sense, but there's a beauty in the fact that none of it makes sense. And I hope somewhere in my narrative journey, there's been some benefit to those people listening to the podcast, because I think it's just about managing your expectations and actually reducing your expectations a little bit.
Okay, so from that, if I was to sum it up, and you can correct me if I've misinterpreted this, so if we were going to, in a nutshell, say to teachers, think about this. So point one, we are educating children in batches of year of birth. We can't, there's nothing teachers can do to change that. However, what they can do is prioritise, and this is perhaps easier in primary when you have the children all day every day than in secondary. However, I think it's no less important that we prioritise getting to know the children that we teach. And that then informs how we enable them to learn and the choices, perhaps the choices that they make about how they're going to engage with their learning, and then how we choose to, we'll use the term assessment, not in terms of standardized testing, but in terms of formative assessment, and allowing them to drive the assessment, the formative assessment, and show us as teachers what they know, what skills they have, what they understand in their own way that really showcases that.
It's exactly that. And it's about almost allowing the learner to define their journey. You know, if I'm honest, what each educator needs to really think is, do they love education? You know, do you love the kind of process? What are your loves? If you express your loves to the space and to the people, then their loves will also mature. And I do that as a nurse, as someone who practitioners, I ensure that they know that I'm broken. You know, I am sure that they know that I'm tired, that it's all been difficult, because it's at that moment that they also open. So, you know, explain to these children that you adore them. You know, you adore the way that they are. And I talk about being happily broken, and people are like, that really annoys me, because you can't. Well, actually, no, I walk very much with the truths that I carry, and I tell people, and I think you will be someone that understands that very much, having been kind of involved in that maturation of our friendship, where I tell you what my heart says. And in order for that to then have an impact, the child will tell you what their heart's saying, and that's where learning happens. That's where the child will open, and they will love, and they will love the journey, and your journey together, you know, in a really beautiful way, not in a way that is defined by others. And there's going to be some bravery, you know, there's going to be like people who have to challenge cultures and the way that it is done, and continue to challenge the culture in the way. And I would love to support people to do that. I would love to change things. And that's kind of legacy, isn't it? That's what I hope, is that as a dyslexic child and someone who wasn't classically word dyslexic, but actually is very alternatively organizationally dyslexic, that you will open so many of these kids, and they are all beautiful in their own way, right or left hemisphere, no matter. But if you could just open a few more right hemispheric brains, then, you know, we've got a really good chance of changing a lot more than just how it feels in that classroom. You will be told, like Jonathan Barnes says, of histories that people tell you, their stories that were affected by one point in time, and you would not imagine the end point. And that's my example, really. You know, I'm kind of coming to the point of understanding through unlearning, and that's a really special thing to be able to do. And I hope that it has impact, and I hope that it's something that punctuates my PhD. Yeah.
So as well, it's about saying to teachers, look, be patient and be forgiving. Not everyone's going to learn how you learn. You've got 30 individuals, embrace them all. They all bring something. And you know, not all of those 30 are going to love your subject.
No.
And exactly. Is that a bad thing? Because no. It's hard to sit in however many hours of history a week when you don't love history. And I think sometimes teachers get frustrated by that. Children aren't putting in their effort, but actually they need to think themselves, do they love every subject? Do they,
exactly.
You know, if we asked a historian perhaps to go out and lead running club, maybe they might have a view on that. So it's about being patient and understanding as well that we're working with humans.
It's something to do with like a love language. So there's a language that you need to either learn, you know, you need to be multilingual in the classroom. You need to learn the love languages of all of them. The difficult child, especially, because actually what they're telling you through that discomfort is a language of love. They're saying, you know, I'm pained. And there are some really beautiful kind of poems around, you know, how, you know, that if you were only to lie down with those children, if you were only to be in that place with those children, if you were only to be in the space where they're showing you that discomfort, then you would truly see the stars that they're looking at. You know, Oscar Wilde famously says, you know, anyone who wants to kind of see the stars, lie down in the gutter with me. You know, that's definitely not a direct quote because I can't remember it, but ultimately I use that all the time because that's the place that I position myself. And I say to adult learners, you know, look, don't pretend. You know, I'm not going to pretend that I'm some master of kind of learning. I'm not some, you know, oracle of nursing, but what I do have is good patient responses, and what I do have is really good learning spaces, but that's got nothing to do with me. All of my narratives are self-deprecating in terms of not using language that's deprecating, but actually I don't matter, the more that I demise self, the richer the environment becomes. And I think that's what we've got to get better at, learning the language and taking yourself, ego-led self, out the room. True self, be there.
Mm-hmm. And that's what you do, is it then? Let's take you to your present day. So despite all of your school experiences and spending so long in the corridor, you are now an academic and you educate others. No, so our future nurses.
I'm not an academic.
I knew you would challenge that. But officially, you are deemed to be an academic and you educate others. And so I think I've just got a taste of what you do bring now in your own teaching, and that of bringing your true self and not the ego self. But if you could just very kind of maybe identify three key things, you don't have to do three, it could be just there's one thing, but some key things that you do within your teaching sessions that enable all of those different people to learn and succeed.
So I think I was asked, actually, it was a really lovely moment where I was asked by a lot of college students. So I went along to Canterbury College, where I was doing kind of like an engagement exercise where they kind of asked me to go along and talk about. And I've got this little Animoto that I show around dyslexia, because I show them people, like Walt Disney, who wasn't good enough at drawing. The Beatles weren't, their music wasn't wanted. Dyson, he made thousands of versions of the vacuum until the first one was accepted and patented. That I show them failure is a really beautiful thing. So the first thing I do is I open the room to failure. So I say, look, let's fail beautifully, but try to kind of navigate this journey together, and there is no problem, because if you take that denominator out, then fear tends to reduce. I use poetry and I use music and I use narrative and I use discomfort a little, and I use experiences of patients, and I use my own heart song. So I say I use the Poetic Nursing Heart, because that's very much the blog that I'm sure people can kind of go along and have a look at, because it is really unusual. I've found my students out in practice, and one of them is a very, very autistic Asperger's, and she was really struggling with the environment of work. And what I taught her was nothing to do with her. Absolutely nothing. It was all to do with the organization. And the moment she understood that as ingredients, she's now absolutely fine. And she's written a small blog called Two Jewels, where she writes to me and she describes me as a tattooed alien. And I love that. That's what I want as my appraisal. I want that statement in my appraisal. But obviously, there are linear processes to do with employment that we won't talk about. But that's the best description I've ever had levied at me, because she talked about the fact that I'd come from another planet and I spoke to her in a language that was true to only her in the room. And so it's something to do with that. And I get in trouble because people say, Tom, you've got to evidence these things. And that's why I still failed a lot of my master's assignments to start off with. So a lot of my masters were 50%, because I kind of didn't quite meet the learning outcomes, just below 50, because it was a master's. So, and then they told me what to do, and then I knew the language, and I got 90 and 95. So my transcript reads 50-50-50, but the truth to the exam board and the external was 70-90-95. So, understand that each of those people in the room maybe aren't learning the language that you are trying to put forward, and maybe you need to modify that. I don't know if there were three in there. I think there were kind of three in there.
I think probably. And I think that's important, helping children to decode what this is all about.
Yeah.
And whilst going back to what we said, acknowledging that they won't all be interested.
No.
And that's fine. And that they will all want to approach it in a different way, because you bring as a child your own experiences as well, and your own views and what you've seen and how what you love and how you've spent your time. So how did you feel then, just finishing off? Because in 2019, so very recently, you were put forward for and then subsequently won the Times Higher Education Award for the most innovative teacher of the year in higher education. So you must be doing something right after all of this corridor time and so on. So how did that make you feel?
Really, really uncomfortable. Mostly because, so it's as if, like, you know, in Fantasia where you have this amazing kind of like where there's loads of things that occur there, or like the Mad Hatter. I use him as an alter ego in my poetry. And sometimes I take on the manifestation of the Hatter, because eccentricity arguably gives us a stronger grasp of reality. I like to use metaphor. So I was using all of these things, and someone found out about it, and it was like 3 years of evidence in the poetic blogs that I was creating, and they decoded the language and then they submitted that. So it felt really unusual, because it was like, you know, it was a beautiful place and it was a really special award and it was a really beautiful night, but what it was, it wasn't recognizing the community. So there's a huge community of people that are built around the Poetic Nursing Heart. So the award wasn't sort of for me, if you want. It was about like the poetry of the butterflies and the flame, and that I use a lot of metaphor in my poetry, and I think that's what I'm trying to have done. And I think it's definitely something that needs to move into more of kind of your faculty of kind of thinking as well. So into education as it is in health at the moment, I think there's so much opportunity where I could be really uncomfortable for people in a really positive way.
Okay, it's been really fascinating talking to you, Tom. And in a nutshell then, so it would say to teachers, remember all of your children are individuals. Open your classroom roof and let them see the stars, and embrace learning and unlearning for what it is. And whilst it's really challenging, try so hard to not become systematized. The targets and the performativity of education is there. We can't avoid it, but be brave within your own classrooms to make it a joyous experience for all.
Absolutely. I couldn't do any better. And it's just around learning that language of love. Yeah.
Lovely. It's been great talking to you.
Thank you.